If you haven't been drinking Athletic Brewing, there was a great write-up about it in the Wall Street Journal saying it's basically the best brewery beverage company out there right now. Award-winning brews, including online exclusive Soul Sour, Spiced Hot Chocolate, and Tucker's West Coast IPA. I am more partial to the Athletic Light because it's something I can drink many of and it's very low in calories. Friends of the Dave Chang Show can get the code, use the code ATHLETICGIFT20, all one word, to get 20% off your first order. Let's get on to the show with Steve Chang. This episode is brought to you by Pure Leaf Iced Tea. Great iced tea takes you somewhere else, like new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea that we have here at the Spotify Studios and drink quite a bit, where unexpectedly blackberry flavor transports you to a berry delicious place. So refreshing, you may never want to leave. You will eventually have to, though. But take your time. Try new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea. Visit amazon.com/pureleaf and enter 20 Pure Leaf. That's 20 Pure Leaf for 20% off your purchase of new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea. This episode is brought to you by Vital Farms. No matter how you like your eggs, scrambled, over easy, or sunny side up, the people at Vital Farms believe in one thing: keeping it bullshit free. That's why their pasture raised eggs come from hens who each have over 108 square feet of space to roam and forage all year round. So you can spend less time questioning your food and more time enjoying it. Look for Vital Farms in your grocery store and learn more at vitalfarms.com. Vital Farms, keeping it bullshit free. Welcome to the Dave Chang Show, part of the Ringer Podcast Network, presented by Major Domo Media. Thank you, Yola Tengo, as always. We have an interview today with my good friend, Steve Chang. Probably not have heard about Steve, but he has been instrumental in a lot of the products and businesses you probably use or support, besides being a very successful venture capitalist. And I don't think he's the traditional one. He is unique in many ways, not just as a successful investor business person, but he just has a good general sense of where culture is going. That's sort of his job. And he's not your traditional setup in how that all happened in his career. This podcast, we're not going to go deeper into that. We're going to have him again. I think we can do a longer one. In the podcast, we referenced the Tim Ferriss podcast. Steve does a really good job of distilling many of the popular topics about Korean and Korean American culture. He's just full of wisdom. Very excited to have him on. And I wanted to get his take on some of the businesses he's investing in and some of his thoughts about where food and AI are going to go. So yeah, we're going to have more interviews moving forward. So yeah, enjoy. Steve Chang, I don't know how to describe you to people. Because you're not just a venture dude, you know?
You know, I do some film stuff.
Yeah.
Do some restaurant stuff.
I don't even think it's that. Because I would say, not that I know all the people in the world of venture capital, far from it, but you seem to be one of the few people that are non-traditional venture capital kind of people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a new generation, even though, as you said, I'm old.
You're not old. You're not old.
We got to stop that. The Korean stuff where we're like, you know, being like 2 years apart and then you call them like big brother and old.
I know.
Yeah. That's like, you know.
Why?
We're American.
Korean American.
Yeah. It's a new country. It's a new nation. We'll talk about that.
We'll talk about that. But I always have a hard time pinpointing what you do, who you are, other than you have one of the great gifts, which is to break down complex pieces of information or concepts into sort of simple 2 to 3 sentences, right? Number one. Number two, you seem to know everyone. You know, we walk into the Spotify office and he was like, oh, Daniel. I was like, who the hell are you talking about? I was like, oh.
Daniel and I go way back. Early music streaming days. Like 2008. That's like 16, 15 years ago.
And you knew back then that Spotify was going to be a thing.
Yeah, because I had my friends and I had the first on-demand music streaming service, and we got sued into oblivion by all the music labels and publishers after trying to work with them. So we had 100 million monthly active users, and we were just constantly trying to work with the music labels and publishers, and it was a crazy time. It was when all the social networks became big, and the music industry, it was pretty back. I mean, it's still backwards, but it was really backwards back then in terms of like what was happening with technology. They try to fight Napster and LimeWire, all the peer-to-peer music sharing services, and they failed. And then when streaming came around, they were just like, they looked at it as, hey, we just got used to music downloads and people paying for music downloads. The streaming thing is going to gut that.
And so, and that's sort of what I wanted to have you on. And I want to talk about so many things, but we got a double podcast today with Bianco and Kelly coming on later. You didn't get into investing. That wasn't your primary goal. And there's a lot about you so people can read all that stuff. I wanted to have you on because it seems like you've had a really good track record of predicting what is actually going to be useful in the future, right? Many facets of this Steve Jang, right? So I want to talk about that. And I want to talk about all things Korea, if we can do it very quickly. And if you haven't the time, you should all listen to the one you did with
Tim Ferriss.
Yeah. That was probably one of the better interviews and synopses of Korean culture I've ever heard.
Well, I actually thought you'd be a lot spicier about that. So.
No, I agreed with all of it.
Oh, really?
That was really good.
Okay. I think I quoted a story about you bringing up Han before, so in that podcast.
It was very good. Too much for me to distill right now.
When I told you about it, I was expecting you to be like, dude, you got X, Y, and Z all wrong.
No.
All right.
No.
I feel better.
What I liked about your interview with him on the podcast was you're explaining to somebody that clearly has an understanding of Japanese culture.
Right, right.
But was aware that they're not the same. Mm-hmm. Right? He actually doesn't know that much about Korean food.
No.
And I think all of your points, I agree with that. It's probably the Trojan horse to explain to a lot of people what Korean culture is. My personal opinion is we're stuck on this hill right now of Korean food because we're still stuck on the second wave of Korean culture. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think we're ever going to get past where we're at right now.
Ooh, okay.
That's my take.
That's spicy. All right.
Right? Mainly because there's nobody that's going to, not nobody. It's hard to explain all the nuance. If you think about just food, mm-hmm. right? There's just too much to explain about what to eat, how to eat in terms of the regions, right? To me, that's the next wave. And you're not even seeing that with Japanese food. You're not seeing that with the food of Mexico. You're not seeing that with anything. It's not just Korean culture. I think it's most of the cultures out there that will never get that deep penetration.
I mean, why is that?
I think it takes work and people are fucking lazy.
Are you talking about the American palate?
I'm not just talking about palate. I'm thinking about really being able to empathize and trying to be in another culture's shoes, both in how they live and in the food they eat.
All right. I'm going to differ with that because I think you guys, and you know, Momofuku included, was at the spear point of this. You guys broke open the mindset and the palate, right? And I think people are ready to explore that. I mean, I see that in LA and New York. I mean, it's not happening in San Francisco yet, but LA and New York, there's different types of cuisine. It's not just Korean barbecue.
No, I have no doubt that, and I will say that we were really much at the forefront of opening people's eyes that Asian food mm-hmm. isn't this monolithic type of thing, right? We were part of this whole thing with Roy Choi, with Corey, with all of these people. A lot of them happen to be Korean American.
Yeah.
And again, it's not an apples to apples, but you know, and I talk about this a lot. New York City is probably the epicenter of modern Korean food in outside of Korea, probably even Korea, right? I don't think people know what the hell they're eating.
What you're saying is they haven't eaten the original version of these dishes, and so they don't know where it's come from.
They don't know what's contemporary.
Right.
Now we're at a place where Korean culture and Korean food, and again, I use Korean food and Korean culture as a variable that could be replaced with anyone. It was 5, 10, 15 years behind. Now, everything with social media and the internets, we're all at the same place. But now, to be able to go deeper into things, it's very hard. I remember when we opened up Kawi right before the pandemic, I thought it was extremely exquisite, modern Korean food. But people didn't know what the hell we were doing.
How did Korean Americans respond to it?
I think that was the first restaurant that they liked that was like Korean.
I don't think it was the first place where I sat down and I had like gourmet kimbap.
Yeah.
Like, and I got so full because kimbap. That's like poor country food. I try to tell people Korean food, like real Korean food, is comfort food. and it's made to like give you bulk.
Yeah.
It's not, it's an efficient food, right? There's like 10 main ingredients, and then it's like rice is there to bulk it up. And that was the first time I had like a really delicious sit down meal. I remember this. I was sitting down and you'd set me up with the reservation. Thank you. I came in last minute. I was like, this is awesome. And the decor was like amazing. The ambiance.
I mean, you were in Hudson Yards, but well,
yeah. Yeah.
But like, you know, there were a lot of things that, and well, you know, we had Unjo doing amazing things and some people got it, but again, there's a lot of modern things in food, not just in Korean food, that you need to spend time.
Yeah.
You need to live there. Not necessarily live there. I would say you just need to study. You need to understand things. You need to know why things are a certain way. And I'm not saying it's because people can't do it. I just think it's a time issue, a resource issue.
So as a non-chef who is more on the like enjoyment side of it, I think it's happening. I think there are delicacy restaurants. They've always been there in K-Town in LA. You know, they've been there in New York for the most part, especially if you go out to like Queens. And today, all the modern, more fusion-oriented ones that you basically helped kick off in Manhattan, like those are some incredible experiences, right? And they're all different, right? So I actually think we're going to that third generation of blank American like cuisine. Like I see a lot of like Moroccan and North African stuff happening in the Bay, SF. I don't know if it's happening in LA, but I see it in San Francisco Bay Area. I think there's a lot of new Indian takes, right? Everyone's still waiting for Dishoom to open up in the US because that's everyone's like go-to in London. And that's like an Iranian Indian cuisine essentially. So I don't know. I think, you know, you're the expert, you're the chef, but
I'm wrong a lot.
I go out to seek these things out and I love to see it. And I think it's happening. I think you guys, you broke the seal and people are down to explore that. So I feel pretty optimistic about it.
I don't want to make it seem like I'm not optimistic about it. I just think that we're sort of stuck in the same gear, right?
Yeah.
And I'm all about trying to push things forward as far as they can go.
I was telling someone the other day, they're like, they were asking me a question about some of the projects you're working on. I said, what you have to understand about the old Dave is that he starts off hating everything and then he learns to love things selectively. I was like, now as a family man, as an older, like wiser Dave, I was like, he's actually more open-minded from the start. So, you know, like encourage those entrepreneurs and those chefs that want to do something different and very specific. You know, I think that's part of the beauty of all the media that you're doing.
This will tie into some of the things that I believe you're really good at. Again, being able to forecast the future in some ways. I think there's a lot of things, cultural understandings, whether it's business or operating a restaurant, that have been like platitudes. It's about location. You can't, customer's always right, etc. I think for many years, most of the burden on providing a service or good to the customer, that responsibility was on the chef or the creator. Tiny bit of that responsibility was on the customer. I would now say, not that still most of the responsibility is on the creator, but it's not like 90-10 like it was before. It's like 60-40.
Hey, what does that mean in terms of the experience for them, for the customer?
The reason why we're going to be stuck in the same gear is because most people, I'm not saying everybody, they don't want to do the work. You know, like it's a priori or priori knowledge to some degree, right? Like you need to have some understanding. It's not like you can't appreciate your meal. I talk about this woman I experienced. We're in K-Town. I was with Jose Andres, who was translating for Ana Adria, and you had Juan Marie Arzak, and they were debating, can someone have a great meal without knowing anything about it, right? Or is it just inherently delicious? And yes, once you remove things that are sweet, sour, taste, like chocolate, whatever, the basic things that everyone can agree that people are going to like, but outside of that, it gets more complicated to say that I know that someone's going to like this. And I think now we're at a point where a lot of that common knowledge of what is tasty, what is good, has been almost democratized or commodified to some degree. And that's why like a lot of restaurants are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
In order for us to have something new, I actually think some of that responsibility is on the diner now, who is like aware.
Yeah. Well,
they're appreciating the little nuance that this person's doing that that other person isn't. And I'd say that Japan does it quite well. And this reference point really is from an American perspective, right? Where you could have the top 10 sushiyas in Tokyo all buying the same fish, all using the same rice, same techniques, but it's those little differences here or there, that minutia that real fans are going to appreciate. And I just don't think we're going to develop that real fandom.
Okay, so a couple things are happening right now. I actually was explaining, I was on a Twitter thread with Scott Belsky from Adobe.
Are we ever going to just stop saying formerly known as X or formerly known as Twitter?
I just call it Twitter because I can't call it X. Like, what are you Xing?
I know.
No, just Twitter. It's fine.
How do you grade Elon's brand awareness on that?
I think Twitter is more chaos than before. And unfortunately, it feels like it's mostly male. Like, I don't see like the people I follow that were female. Like, I feel like they're either dormant or gone. So it feels a little bit more like boys club, but it's still important for like certain, like, you know, tech Twitter or crypto Twitter or like food Twitter, but it's just not the same. Threads is actually growing really fast. Yeah. I think Threads is actually growing faster. And I saw some metric that Threads is growing faster than Twitter downloads in the App Store right now.
It's amazing.
I mean, it's
I just, still don't really use
it's
it
just
that
siphoning
much.
Off all of the yeah. Instagram people. Right?
Sorry, I didn't mean to, you know.
Yeah. But you know, we were talking about AI. I'm just saying, if all this creative media and entertainment is getting generated by AI, then you know, where does all the creative, you know, the unique qualities of creative, you know, art and media go? We kind of compared it to this idea of like fast casual food, right? Where you become very efficient, the Chipotle of everything, right? So it's not bad, but it's not great, but it's good enough and it's efficient and it's cost sensitive. So a lot of people can have it, right? It's very mainstream. But what it does is it pushes people up to look for unique, authentic experiences with food, right? And then they're looking for provenance. And in their mind, when they get that story or that folklore about the provenance of this restaurant or this cuisine or this particular new opening, you know, that's where it's a special moment for them. They want to have that unique experience that's high quality because everything, it's good. Every day they get their sort of efficient food, right? But then when they want like a really elevated experience, they can go out to a hole in the wall for that great dish from that Burmese, you know, old aunt, right? That's making that those great bowl of noodles, or it can be a high-end like Michelin star fine dining thing. And so in AI, that's happening, right? Everyone's afraid that it's going to replace jobs, but it's, you know, I hope that what it does is it pushes people upward and forward to do more unique and creative things, right? And so in food, I mean, I think food is a great sort of an analog for that, right? Which is, we had this whole like wave of fast casual that, you know, we saw over the last 20, 30 years, right? And every fine dining chef wants to do a fast casual because they know that that's how it scales and makes money ultimately.
Still fucking hard.
Right? But at least there's like an opportunity because how many, like, let me ask you this. How many Michelin star restaurants are actually barely break even or barely profitable?
I would say 95% of them. There are some that crush,
right?
For sure.
But it's hard, right? Because yeah. There's a natural ceiling because the units, right? And the pricing, like you're constrained as a restaurateur.
At the end of the day, what's going to separate the winners from the losers, at least in profitability or just is execution.
Yeah.
Like everything is out there. There's no secrets anymore.
Yeah.
But going back to the AI, it could tell you to go to that Burmese hole in the wall, as you say. I think the world we're living in and what I'm being, I think, cautious of and trying to understand, because this is still my industry, is maybe 20 years ago, because nobody was talking about it, you could, It was like finding a band or discovering a band that nobody cared about and that's yours. And you could go deep into the food of Burma. And that's your thing. Mm-hmm. I think you're finding less and less people that are willing to go deep into their idiosyncratic interests in food. It's becoming very much the same.
Right?
So you might go to that Burmese hole in the wall, but you're not going to try to find any other ones. You're not going to try to find out different parts of the cuisine. And that's what I mean with Korean food. I don't think people are going to understand the regionality.
Hmm.
And it's not just Korean food. You could, the food of India.
Right.
I mean, how much do most people just think it's one clump? Even still today, the food of China, it's just one thing. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I just think it's something to put into consideration that with all of this access to technology, it has not necessarily made it better. Accessibility, one thing, yes. Mm-hmm. But I think refinement, no.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Vital Farms. No matter how you like your eggs, scrambled, over easy, or sunny side up, the people at Vital Farms believe in one thing, keeping it bullshit free. That's why their pasture-raised eggs come from hens who each have over 108 square feet of space to roam and forage all year round. So you can spend less time questioning your food and more time enjoying it. Look for Vital Farms in your grocery store and learn more at vitalfarms.com. Vital Farms, keeping it bullshit free.
And well, what I'm hoping for and what I'm starting to see is that people learn sort of the mainstream version of it, right? They learn the General Tso's chicken version of a cuisine, and then they move forward and if they like it, they seek out more, right? And so, you know, hopefully it's an efficient marketplace where people like restaurateurs and chefs and mom and pops see that opportunity, right? Like Sean Famous Foods, right? When that came out, like, I remember everyone saying, wow, I've never heard of this. I was like, this is one of the oldest cuisines you can think of coming out of Central Asia. You know, it just does that one particular dish. Now there's like three or four of those in San Francisco, right? And so I think that it spreads out. I think it just takes time. I mean, you were doing it very, very early on in, I remember someone in New York saying, hey, do you want to go get, go to a sambar. I said, oh, what do you like there? And they were explaining it. I said, oh, that's Korean food. And they're like, no, it's not. It's Japanese food. I was like, oh, it's both, but it's really Dave's creation. It's a hybrid of many things, right?
I think that bothers a lot of Korean people.
Yeah. I think for Koreans, they're like, this is not Korean food.
It's not Japanese food. But I've said this time and time again, I'm much more comfortable in Japan than I am in Korea.
But that's why noodle bar and sambar were so powerful and popular, was that it wasn't Korean or Japanese. You couldn't get it anywhere else. You could not like it, but it was an N of one. Like, there was no other like alternative, right?
Well, without trying to sound like a self-important jackass, it was a distillation of a lot of the things that I lived. And for example, the tteokbokki, rice cakes.
Yeah.
Koreans, I love tteokbokki, but it's always soft and gooey in the gochujang sauce.
Yeah.
My grandfather spent most of his life in Japan. And in Japan, you can see it like on the street. There's like a little grill and they're roasting mochi, their version of rice cake.
Yeah.
And put a little soy sauce, maybe a little honey. It's delicious. I'm just merging these two things that I experienced quite a bit in my life. And it's neither Korean, it's neither Japanese.
Koreans like their tteokbokki al dente.
Yeah, no. And I'm okay to say that. It's like, it's better, but I can turn it into something else.
But that's why it was good. And that's why people liked it. And that's why even Koreans liked it. Korean Americans liked it a lot, because it felt like you were walking into Dave's crazy home kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And you were cooking like recipe. I mean, remember you and I had that conversation about like the greatest $5 meal? Oh, it's Shin ramyeon with Popeye's chicken sliced really, really cleanly and laid gently on top of it. And you could sprinkle some green onions and you could probably sell that for like $25 but it costs you less than $5 to make.
I'm glad we're going here in terms of Korean culture, because I still want to get to some of your predictions. Sorry. This is a conversation we've had quite a bit. And I know my stance on representation about AAPI things are certainly in the minority.
Yeah.
Definitely in the minority. I've gotten in a lot of fights with people, not altercations, but massive disagreements. I don't love just blindly celebrating. I understand the importance of solidarity, and that I'm all for. But at what point are we celebrating? Like, there's a lot of Korean organizations.
Yep.
And I think the goal of these organizations is to, yes, solidarity, but the end goal is to be able to be part of a larger community that is vibrant and diverse, not exclusive.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that was my whole thing, is that we should be trying to focus our efforts on trying to be as excellent as possible and not just talking to only Korean people.
Yeah.
And I'm in the minority.
Or Asian American people.
I don't know why. People get super pissed when they hear that. Not people, but a lot of these supporters of some of these organizations.
No, I think there are a lot of people that think like that. I think you in particular, just knowing you, dude, like, you are very contrarian. So if you feel a slight bit uneasy with a movement or a trend or a meme, like, you will lean into that contrarianism. That being said, I don't disagree with you. I think that it's important to always be, you know, building something like leadership or influence through showing is always more important than just the telling, I think, right? Like, that's what we all want for ourselves, to be able to accomplish something and then be able to, you know, pay forward some type of learning or lesson or whatever from that. And I think that you're probably more like that. And you would, you know, rather not like tell people. I think your own like phony bullshit meter is really strong when you look at yourself. So, but I think a lot of people actually want that solidarity. They want to know that we're not just a small group, that we can be a bigger group together, and they need that support network. So I think it's actually great that, you know, there's a AAHNPI, right? Hawaiian Native. You got to add that in because they're not necessarily Pacific Islander. So AAHNPI, that grouping, that wasn't a grouping before. I mean, before, back in the day, I mean, there was like Asian Americans, and that was kind of a group. And then there was Native Hawaiian, right? And then there was Pacific Islanders, right? And now that it's been grouped together, it's just like a voting block, right? It's like the Black Caucus or the Latino Caucus in government, right? Like, it's just, you're taking a bunch of small groups that are regionally kind of related. And, you know, I think that's a good thing. Like,
I'm all for this when it's about, again, solidarity and preserving communities.
Yeah.
Right? But when it becomes a bubble, that's when
But what's the bubble to you?
This is where it gets really contradictory.
Yeah.
And I think why it upsets people.
Yeah.
I want to preserve, and I think it's important, again, to have the ability to know that there's a group of people, within my community that will always support me.
Yeah.
I find that that can be a crutch, and that you're stuck in that bubble. And I think ultimately the reason you're here in America is not just to stick with your own kind,
right,
but to literally be part of a very varied fabric.
Yeah.
And I don't think that ultimately happens. And if you ask me one reason, and clearly Asian culture has changed quite a bit over the past 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're just talking about Korean culture, it's different than Korean American culture, but we'll lump them into one thing.
Yeah.
What has changed, and why is being Korean cool?
Yeah,
right now.
Yeah.
Still not cool, but like way fucking cooler than it's ever been.
Yeah.
Is it because of the solidarity, or is it because of something else?
I don't think it's because of this. I think
it's a leading question.
I think the solidarity is an outcome of that, right? It's an outcome of a lot of things, right? It's an outcome of feeling disadvantaged or feeling like left aside. But I think it's also an outcome of people pushing forward, right? Like Minjin Lee, you know, writing about her stories about like Korean culture and people with living in Japan. You wouldn't think that that would necessarily be an American bestseller, but it was, right? It wasn't a bestseller in Korea first. It wasn't a bestseller in Japan. Definitely not. It was a bestseller in the US because it was a universal story. So I feel like when you create like it's through the creators and the builders and the purveyors of whatever their craft is. Though, and you could be in business too. Those are the people that are creating that sense of pride and then solidarity that comes from it, right? I don't think that the community solidarity is necessarily exclusive of being part of the rest of America. I think there are a lot of Asian American AAPI, AHNPI groups that are trying to be very like intersectional with others, right? I think that's always a challenge, right? To be have solidarity and then always, you know, and then think about the other as well. But I think they're trying. So I think it's a good movement. I think what you're talking about is like you'd like to see more things of substance as the focus rather than just talking about ourselves.
Patting each other on the back.
Right.
I mean, it's not that I don't believe in that shit, but I'm like.
So what you're saying is thin line between mutual support network and just talking about mutual
push
support.
Motherfuckers. Let's fucking go.
You know? So as an entrepreneur and now as an investor in like entrepreneurs, the way I think about it is when you're in doubt or when you're not feeling good or when you're feeling angry, even like build something.
Yeah.
Do something.
Yes. Right? Amen. And the idea of Koreanness changing, I think is clearly because of excellence in all parts of culture, right? Minjin Lee is not just because she's a Korean American writing about Korean expatriates in Japan. She's a fucking amazing writer.
Yeah.
First and foremost, who happens to be Korean American.
And that creates this universal appeal, not just of among even Asians. It's
important everyone. That Corey Lee is always seen as the benchmark for being a fucking badass motherfucker, technique wise.
Yeah.
He was Korean American.
But no one knew that the chef, this great chef, or they might have known, but it wasn't a part of the top of their mind when they went to Bennu.
No.
He introduced.
Of course. But it's not even that Korean. It's much elements. More Chinese now.
He introduced those elements late, most recently, right? Like it wasn't part of the.
But he had to prove himself as the number one in the Keller universe.
Do you think that that was his master plan?
No, I think Corey wanted to be with the very best.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. And it was right. Lespinasse. It was all of these things that he worked at.
Yeah.
And I think he's gotten mad respect because of that.
Mm.
I find that as much as I would like it as a simple, transparent, hey, this is what we're doing, accept it.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Music, whether it's BTS or Blackpink, it's like K-pop. It's like one. It's one. It won people over with, I don't know how, but it's music that people like. The fact that people that don't speak Korean listen to K-pop is like the most insane thing in the world to me. It's totally crazy.
And they're learning Korean because of it.
Yeah, they speak better Korean than I do now. But to me, it's about less time, as important as it is, solidarity and community, and more time making fucking badass shit.
Yeah. You're in a position of influence. People look up to you. They want to, you know, they want to touch you. They want to be next to you. They want to be like you. You, I think, are averse to a lot of that because you have issues with that type of attention and almost like deification. You personally don't like it.
Sure, I got all kinds of problems.
But I think for a lot of people, there's a good relationship of like, there's a positive some aspect to it, right? Where look, someone achieves something and then they can uplift others and they can embrace that. Like, you know, like Steve Yeun, he's like winning every award, right? Like he'd win an Oscar.
I'm not talking to him until he wins an Oscar. I told him.
But, you know, Beef wasn't a movie, so he can't win an Oscar. But he will. Like, I think he will. Like, he's just one, like, legitimately one of the best actors working today. Like,
listen, he's a close friend of both of ours. And I say that in jest, right, about him winning a fucking Oscar. But we've had a lot of conversations about this. And I was like, Steve Yeun, whether you know it or not, you are our Michael Jordan right now. You know what I mean? Like, if for transcending Korean culture, Korean-American culture to a global audience, I was like, you are the dude. You know what I mean? Like, you're one of the very few people, if the only person, that could do it. Great actor, handsome, all of these things. And I don't, as much as I joke, I'm not really joking. I was like, you better win that fucking Oscar, motherfucker. You know what I mean? I want to put that pressure on. Not that he needs it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not that it defines him, right? But we need to start
but he's
checking
also,
all these boxes.
But he's a little bit more like you, too, in that he doesn't love that type of attention.
That's the difference. I don't give a shit right. What he loves.
Yeah.
He's got to do it not just for him, for everybody else. And well, he knows that.
So that's what people are saying to you, too, right?
I'm a terrible actor, though.
you're a personality.
No, I'm not, I think.
But people are placing that on you and Steve, right? And I don't think either of you love that type of responsibility and attention. I think that you guys are actually very, in a strange way, like those, you know, introvert, extrovert, right? You know that you feed off of the outside energy. It's important. But deeply internally, like you have a bullshit meter and a high bar on what you want to actually do, right? And so, but I don't think that's true of everyone. And I think that overall in the system of it, right? Like we're talking about like 330 million people in this country, right? Asian Americans represent of this Asian descent. So that could be like, you know, I think that includes, you know, mixed ethnicity, right? So you're talking about mixed race people as well in the US. That's like 20, 22 million people. It's not that many. They have to group together to be that like influence or voting block, right? To support each other. So I think that's an amazing thing. I think a lot of builders and a lot of like creators, a lot of people who are working with their hands or working with their mind to like do one specific thing. I think they're not accustomed to having that support network all around them. It can feel noisy. It can feel like off-putting sometimes. But I think it's important, right? I think giving back and trying to like in your way, like showing a path, maybe even guiding people on a path is cool, right? And it's part of the second half of your career and your life, right?
Yeah, I think.
So we'll do see. It, man. Like show up for those community foundation organizations, like talks and speeches. And then, you know, just go meditate afterwards. You know, I know you like meditation, right?
I'm not going.
I dragged you out once for one of these things. I'll do it again.
I will fight tooth and nail.
I want to see the Zen Dave Chang podcast, like the alter ego one. It's like nice, like pastel colors. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't think that'll ever happen. We met while working on Ondo.
Yeah.
So I've known Steve quite some time, and you are one of the very few people, when I started off the podcast by saying in the venture world, private equity world, whatever it may be, that understood both as a founder and on the investing side, like how to communicate, to be the liaison in a lot of different ways. So I saw that you had the ability to do something that seems pretty easy, but not a lot of people are able to do. And you didn't necessarily plan on doing that. You were in music, and then you were early into Spotify. You were literally one of the first people in Uber, right? Like that's, you're seeing trends. You're continuing to see trends. We don't have to go over your entire portfolio. There are things that you're doing right now that I think really do impact how we're going to eat. And clearly we don't even understand the ramifications of what AI is necessarily going to happen or if it happens at all. But some of these things like wearable technologies, there's a few other things. What are the bets you're taking that are going to have an impact on how we eat in the future?
How we eat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or just when I say that, like how we live, which is synonymous with what we eat.
Yeah. Well, before we...
Even Spotify, every restaurant right now has a Spotify playlist. Right. That's how we eat.
So the company that I worked on with our team was called iMeme. It was pre-Spotify. We built the first user-generated music streaming social playlist widgets service. It was 100 million monthly active users. You could put it on a playlist widget on your MySpace profile. This is like before Facebook got big. And all of that was around, like, this was the same time when YouTube came up. And, like, Chad Hurley and Steve Chen created YouTube. And it was just, like, this white website with, like, video thumbnails. And it would just, you would upload it and you'd be able to play it back. And you could embed it in your blog. Like, all of these technology advances come from, like, a very small thing. Like, everything big and feels like a platform in tech, whether it's Netflix. Netflix came from taking CD-ROMs and DVDs and putting them in envelopes and receiving them in a subscription. That was it. Remember you could only keep three?
I never used Netflix back in the day.
You could only keep three, though. So if you kept three and you didn't send it back, you could never get new movies, right? And it started like that. And I remember I was in grad school at the time and I was like, why can't they stream movies? And it was like 2003 and we had a little business school group and we had to pick one thing. And then we did our presentation on, you know, why can't you just stream movies over the internet? And it was because there wasn't enough bandwidth. But it was logical to everyone in the class. Of course, why would we want to mail back and forth CDs and DVD-ROMs? Like, all of that stuff didn't make any sense. And then with music streaming, it was like, we all had these MP3s that we all got off Napster, LimeWire, Kazaa. They were all sitting on our hard drives. What if we could upload them into a website and we can make playlists and we could play it back and we could put it everywhere on the internet? And that was the initial push for that streaming service, iMeme. Spotify came after that. That's where I met Daniel. He was the founder of uTorrent, a BitTorrent client company out of Sweden. He sold that, stopped doing that, and took that same streaming architecture and said, that technology, and said, why don't I create a streaming service that uses this distributed streaming technology? It's very efficient, right? Like a peer-to-peer node system. Why don't I make a streaming service that's better? So we had built ours off of using data centers like pre-AWS. We would use all these computer servers all around these data centers, all around the country. Daniel's innovation was to use a distributed peer-to-peer architecture for streaming and to make that better. So everyone, all of these big platforms, whether it's Netflix, Spotify, or it's Uber, all came from like one tiny, tiny little solution to like a very personal problem. And so that's, you know, when I think about, you know, the effect it has on life, like, you and I had a conversation about Uber. I remember something that stuck with me that you said was, it changed the game in restaurants. I said, how so? And what? Explain what that was.
Well, for many towns, specifically Los Angeles, it changed Los Angeles dining completely. And I would say most people would think that Los Angeles has gotten infinitely better in the past 15 years. What does that coincide with? Uber. I think a lot of that is because people can drink now and not have to drive. I think DUIs were a massive thing here in LA. Mm-hmm. And when you have that hanging over your head, it does not allow you to freely enjoy the experience. You're always worried about a responsibility.
Right.
And when you're going out to dine, having friends, eat, drink, be merry, it's really nice not to have a worry. You know, it's
yeah.
Like, I know that feeling. I got a babysitter. It's like, oh, we got to get out of here by 10 or whatever. Mm-hmm. When you're able to be in total bliss, if you have that luxury, that changes the game. And that's what happened. And that happened to a lot of cities.
And you just unlock that one thing. It unlocks that one thing and it changes everything. And that's, you know, I will tell you, when Uber was started, it was a side project. Garrett Camp was running another company. And he's a Canadian living in San Francisco. San Francisco has the worst taxi system in the developed world. Like, they would never show up. You would call them. They would say they would come. They wouldn't show up. So he was constantly like an hour or 2 hours late, not only to meet up with friends, but on dates. I remember it was like a huge issue for him. And so he got frustrated, and we were all, this is right when the iPhone came out and Android came out, and he got it in his head. He's like, what if I could order a cab, right? And he's like, but he was like already wealthy. So he was like, no, I want a black car, a Lincoln with a driver. And he said, maybe we could create an app that uses GPS and we could give it to a driver and see what happens. And at first he wanted to buy cars and do that. I said, no, you don't have to buy cars. You don't have to have inventory. It's a whole bunch of headache that you don't need. Travis Kalanick came into the picture and said, like, you can scale this just with like other people's cars. And there's a whole driver workforce that would love to have more income and to be able to do this. Because most limo and black car drivers are sitting around waiting for a reservation. And so that's how it came together. It was just a side project. Nowhere in that seed investment presentation was there something about this is going to unlock, you know, restaurants and the food industry and any of that. They had no idea. These are all downstream like repercussions that are amazing, but they had no idea. You can't predict how it will grow, what it will affect. And it just comes from that one little tiny like use case. Literally a Canadian that doesn't have a driver's license, doesn't have a car, and is like really into mobile apps.
And again, through some kind of Kevin Bacon-like principle, fundamentally altered hospitality and dining, yeah. Right? You know, it's funny. It's like we took that sort of principle when we did Ondo because we were trying to use kitchens that were sort of dark or slow during periods like 2 to 4, 5 p.m. And maybe they could make something. The whole experience was to get everybody on the same page. It would be the rising tide for everybody. But, you know, maybe one day that'll happen. But I was thinking too, going to Spotify and how, as a example to what I was trying to say, that we're stuck in the second wave. And this may seem as a crazy tangent and amazing technology, what Spotify is able to do. And you can share playlists. Algorithm there is actually pretty good now in putting people into buckets. But for example, it would be before Spotify, it was awesome to go to a restaurant and hear playlists that you would not hear anywhere else that were customized. They were like, oh, wow, they're playing the B-side to that.
Well, people were playing Pandora stations.
Some people were. Right. But there were a lot. We were
or
one
iPods,
of them.
iPods.
Yeah,
they
putting
were
on
jacking
iPods.
Jacking in iPods, yeah. No.
And now you hear the same playlists on almost every restaurant. It's true. Like clockwork.
So what you're saying, do you notice it when it's like...
Oh, yeah. And I notice it for sure. They're definitely using Spotify. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that easy accessibility has now prevented people from going deeper into specific bands. Mm-hmm. That's the trade-off, right?
Right. So you're saying that it's like 1% of the music is played at 90% of the venues.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a top 40 problem, right? Like everyone. So, you know, a restaurant like Mr. Juice, Brandon, I saw you were hanging out and you know that I'm an investor there. So disclaimer. But what he's done with the music is he's asked to create like very specific playlists, asked DJ friends. He and his wife picked the music. Rintoro, Izakai Rintoro in San Francisco, another great restaurant. Our friend Eugene Wang, he's a DJ. He actually puts together everything on the music front. And you enjoy it. You appreciate it. You notice it. It's part of the experience now. Just like having a unique menu, right? And so it's that kind of thing where it makes it really efficient to have like a certain level of quality on your music or on your food, right? We were talking about the mass customization of like fast casual. It just, people want to have provenance. They seek the soulful version of, you know, going out for a meal. And so when they think about music and you add that, that's just how like humans are. Like, you know, industrialization pushed us to want like, you know, to go out into the woods, to go out into the country, to go into nature, right? Like we all were fucking running around in nature and we hated it. And we wanted to get into the city. We wanted like modernization and we wanted electricity.
My ancestors were all indoorsmen. They did not like going outside.
But that's the evolution of how all this stuff changes. And so when you think about like Uber or you think about AI now, right? People are like very scared of it. And I think it's actually replacing white collar jobs and knowledge worker jobs more than it's replacing like blue collar jobs.
That's why I'm really bullish on people being in the cooking profession. It's gonna be hard. We're many years away from robots taking us over.
No, yeah, and it's like I think that's probably the wrong direction for the fear or the concern. I think it's more sort of like how you create. So if you believe that software and data kind of drive everything at this point, what AI is mainly doing right now. Today, this year, next year, maybe the year after that, it's really focused on how to create better software and use data in a more intelligent way. So,
are you investing in anything that can change an individual's perspective on like how they dine, because whatever they're doing now is always they're just a sponge of data for whatever electronics is on their body.
Yeah. I mean, we have, you know, there's a few companies, I think none of them are stealth anymore, so I think we can talk about them, but so Humane is one. It's an ex-Apple team, and they're building an AI pen. I've got it in my pocket, actually. I'll show it later. And it allows you to ask questions. It's multimodal. It has a camera, has a microphone. You can ask it questions. You can find out different things on the go, hands-free, eyes-free. You're not looking at your phone all the time. But it also allows you to take photos and videos and assess how many calories is this? What am I eating? So there's a lot of knowledge from the greater internet that these LLMs or these generative AI models bring right to your fingertips or right to your microphone, right? And so that's changed. That's out in the wild. That's not you sitting inside of your office or your home. Just like
you don't have to Google how many grams of protein are in this chicken breast. You're looking at it.
Yeah.
And it's instant.
I mean, you can tap and like take a video of it and it'll tell you what's in it. Tell you how many calories, right? AI is doing a lot on that computer vision aspect, and then also accessing all it's distilling data that's compressed from the greater internet and public data that's out there. Every website, every database that's been exposed publicly, it's taking all that, synthesizing it, giving you an answer. There's another company called Perplexity, which is an AI search engine. It's basically replaced almost all of my Google searches. And Perplexity is using a bunch of different LLMs, these foundational models, and also searching across the web and creating an index, just like Google would create an index, but they're creating it from real-time information. And so Perplexity offers an answer rather than a web page of blue hyperlinks, right? I think people are now over the idea of having all these ads paid for. When you do that first search page result, it's just a bunch of website links that are stale. And so Perplexity offers that. So when you go in there, you can ask for what type of dish is this? What's in it? What are some restaurants that are great in New York that are well-reviewed? What are the new restaurants serving this cuisine? You can do all that. And Google would not give you that. Google will give you like a bunch of eater links, maybe some infatuation links, and a bunch of paid sponsor stuff that might be irrelevant. There's another company that we just announced today an investment in, Particle. It's an ex-Twitter team that built the applications and the machine learning behind Twitter, not X, but Twitter, left. And they're building basically an AI newsreader to give you what you want, give you the whole picture, aggregate it, summarize it, and let you follow that topic rather than articles. So it's called Particle. And they just announced today. And think about like podcasts, right? What do? You go open up like, you know, Bill Simmons, Ringer podcast, or you open up NPR, or you open up some other podcast, Acquired. And you put it on speaker and then you go cook and you do something and it's ambient audio. That's like Gen 1 behavior, right? Cool. That's expensive. That costs like tens of thousands of dollars for each episode to be filmed and recorded and edited. And then you have to invite guests. And then there's a whole orchestration on producing that. Now imagine if you could pick a topic, right? It could be anything from like Taylor Swift to AI, whatever it is. And it would take all of the known content out there and synthesize it and give you something to learn from, to listen to, and enjoy. So AI can do a lot of stuff orchestrating different data and content from around the internet and give it to you in a way that's really like easy and consumable. So all of this is like knowledge workers. How do you create software? How do you create, you know, healthcare data? Like, it's crazy that there's not one trusted brand that we can just ask like health-related questions and get a trustworthy answer. It's crazy, right? Why is that happening? It's because of like government regulation that's a little overwrought. It's because of insurance companies. It's because of health systems. It's all old school silos of data. If we could just use AI to make that all simplified and bring that all so that, look, like my family, I hate when like something's going on with one of our kids. I have to like make an appointment or I have to go to the ER. Neither of those work. Who wants to take a kid to the ER? That's like the worst place on the planet to take them, right? It's like, it's not an ideal situation. And then you have to schedule a call, right? Or, you know, if you're wealthy enough, you have a concierge, right? These things shouldn't be like this. And AI and software and data can help solve a lot of these things. So when I think about the fear of AI, I don't think about the, I mean, there are certainly things to be worried about and have anxiety about and to push back on and to shape in the way that you want it. But the upside benefit is huge. In education and healthcare alone, that has like a trickle-down effect on every part of society globally. Like if we were to focus in on how can that low-income student or that developing nation kid have the same access to education and tutoring that anyone else can have in a private school in a big city in the US, that would be incredible. Healthcare, I mean, we just talked about it, but there's so many different areas where information, trustworthy information is so key. So, you know, we're not even talking about like entertainment and media and creative arts and food. Like these are all luxuries. These are not on the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like the most important thing. They are important, but like think about all the incredible things that can be solved with AI.
So it's going to make people more knowledgeable diners.
Yes. That is in the story arc of AI.
That's a disaster for restaurants.
That's
because it makes everyone a fucking more of a pain in the ass.
That's a disaster for restaurants.
I say that as a joke. Yeah.
But doing like shitty things, right? Doing mediocre things for sure.
I think it arms people to become more of an expert opinion maker. You know, more armchair bullshit.
Well, transparency is good, right?
Sure.
Right? Like I was reading something about Kent cigarettes in the 50s and 60s put asbestos filters in their filters. And so it was like double cancer. It was like smoke as well as like asbestos. And, you know, it's like people didn't know. Mm. So it's like the faster we get to like understanding like the world around us, but also the things that we like put in our body and we put next to us, we put our kids in, like this is really important, right? And so, yeah, it's a disaster. I know you're joking, but it's a disaster for people who are cutting corners, mm-hmm. right? But that pushes us upward and forward to be higher quality about the things we do, about how we live. That to me is the benefit of AI is that the first act of AI is like, it's going to like wreak havoc on a lot of our systems, right?
Is AI going to be like the Y2K?
No. Because Y2K was like a false danger and like nothing happened.
But also the, you know, everything was like redtubesocks.com. Like everybody had some kind of bullshit website.
Yeah. I mean, but that's how everything starts, right? It's like everything starts out super simple. Like we were saying, it's like, it starts out with like one particular person's point of pain and they solve it. And then millions of people start doing that. And most of that stuff goes away because it's terrible, right? But it's a Darwinian thing where like this thing that was a pain point for me or a pleasure point for me, and I started building a solution for that. Wow, 100 people agreed with me essentially, and they want to use it too. And that's where it becomes like a big thing. So everything big that we all like depend upon and we like love or hate, and we like, you know, everyone's like, it's funny how much people like talk shit about their iPhone or their Netflix account or their Spotify account. I'm like, in the big picture of things, Maybe iPhones are expensive, but Netflix and Spotify, it's like you could total it all up and it wouldn't even be a one parking ticket in LA.
Right.
And it's like, but everyone has a strong opinion about it, right? And what it is, it's a utility. It's important to you. And so you have a strong opinion about it. In food, like, yeah, you have a strong opinion. Like I went to SFO airport. I only eat fast food, like chain fast food at airports. I love it actually. I went to Burger King, which I love. I don't like McDonald's. I like Burger King.
Wow, hot take.
I went to a classic chicken sandwich, you know, the one with the mayo, the like tangy mayo. It was $18 for that and fries. I took a photo of it and they were like, why are you taking a photo of it? I'm like, that's fucking ridiculous. That's crazy. And I thought about it. I was like, inflation, right? It's also a classic, but it has folklore to me. It has emotion. I'm like, I wanted that. I came in wanting it. So I got it. Enjoyed it. And I think about like food, it's like we are so trained now to like trust like the Chipotles of the world, and there's like this thing in San Francisco called Sushi Rito. It's like a burrito made of like, and all these like white collar workers love it, right? I'm like, it sounds terrible to me.
It's just kimbap.
I mean, and we know that, right? But the point is like we all like want that efficient meal. But then when you go out on a date or you have free time, what do you want to do? You want to go out and like have like that unique dining experience. Mm. Same thing in all of this technology, right? You might listen to your Spotify playlist or watch like whatever pops up as recommended or hot on your Netflix. But there'll be a moment where you want to go to a theater. There'll be a moment where you want to sit down with the whole family and you'll be really concerted and like thoughtful about what you want to do. So I'm not worried about everyone becoming like a droll, like mindless bot, like all consuming the same stuff. And like, there's no opportunity to do something unique in food or music or culture. I'm not worried about that because people will always strive to do something different, right? This isn't a, like,
you hear that, Steve Young? You better win that fucking Oscar.
I did ask him to send us questions. He didn't do it. He's off skiing right now.
Well, we got to go. I regret that we didn't schedule longer because I think we could talk for several hours from me and you, and we're going to have you on. You're in LA a bunch, so we won't wait nearly as long to get you on the show. Where can people find you and where?
They can't find me like physically.
No.
But we're in San Francisco.
What's your company?
Venture capital fund called Kindred Ventures. And you can find me on Twitter or Instagram. That's easy enough. And thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Steve.
Good to see you.
Give us 5 stars.